Well, I always like to describe history as like an onion. You peel off one layer.
Yes.
That's interesting. But then there's another layer beneath, and you can keep peeling down to a very granular level or going back in time. The level of detail is just a wonderful thing to behold. And then it's the difficulty for a good historian is to be the storyteller that can capture the most interesting parts without sounding too technical or too inside baseball, where you lose that human story element. You've got to keep the facts in there, but pick which facts you can fit into the narrative that you're trying to convey and keep it accessible.
Steve Sherlock here for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, anywhere on the internet at WFPR.FM and in the local Franklin, Mass. Area dial at 102.9. Here in studio for the first time in a while. And we have a special guest today, Chris Wolfe. Chris, welcome.
Hi, Steve.
Glad to have you here. And for the listeners, we're about to go on a journey that starts to a certain extent from Afghanistan, but ends up here in Franklin. So for those who don't already know, I'll give a little bit of a blurb that my introduction to Chris was when I heard he was going to be speaking at the second Sunday speaker series at the Historical Museum. So I went, and you did that, it was in March. It was the second Sunday in March.
Yeah.
Time's flying. You know, this COVID world, even though we're coming out of it, it's like, what day is it? So yeah, the second Sunday in March, and you did a wonderful presentation on your new book, Bumbling Through the Hindu Kush, and you've got a tagline. I'll let you do that part.
Yeah, Bumbling Through the Hindu Kush, and the subtitle is A Memoir of Fear and Kindness in Afghanistan.
Yes, the memoir piece is key.
Yes.
And your daughter kind of prompted you to write the book?
So the book is the story of my misadventures as a young journalist in Afghanistan. I was working for the BBC and went to go see if I'd like the life of a foreign correspondent. So where do you go? You bumble into Afghanistan and run into all kinds of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And then have been dealing with the consequences of that through the rest of my life. It was a little traumatic. And at my daughter's prompting recently, she said, why don't you write it all down and get it out of your system? And so I did. And that was very helpful to have her in mind as I was writing, because I know that she knows nothing about Afghanistan, for sure, nothing about war, no interest in military matters at all, and not even anything about journalism.
Right.
And so as the cheesy marketing line would have it, I try and bring everyone along on the journey, because too many memoirs of or stories about faraway, complicated places are written to try and impress people in policy circles and think tanks, and the regular readers just get lost in an alphabet soup of acronyms and jargon and inside baseball knowledge.
Right.
Whereas I try and bring everyone along on the journey, as I say, because I want to share a story and share it as widely as possible. If I can.
Yeah, and it certainly is. Trying to come up with the right adjective as we started talking off air, I did finish the audio version, so I've been hearing your voice for a while.
Thank you. Glad you were able to survive that.
It was not just a matter of surviving. It kept me going. Obviously, I had a few other interests in there as well. I don't know that much about a war. I had started recording my father's story, who had been World War II, served in Saipan, Tinian, and then Iwo Jima, and ended up walking off, but then didn't talk about that until just before, I was hoping it was going to be a lot longer than that, but it was just before he actually passed, I managed to get him to talk about it. I managed to get from his beginning of his life, 1928 to 1953. So I've got that part of the story recorded, which was some of the key pieces. But then the really interesting part from us, odd perspective, I was born in 53. So I didn't get the kind of the current issues, and we'll have to fill in that, et cetera. So from a war perspective, it was like, well, you've been close to combat.
Yes. So anyone who knows anybody who's been in really exposed to combat or really any kind of trauma very often will not talk about it at all. I had a very similar situation with a relative who'd been through World War One and just sat in the corner, would never talk about it or open up. I think it's a very common amongst veterans of war in particular, but any trauma more widely as well. So I do approach my writing in the book with that sense of humility, that I only had a taste of fear, as I said, a taste of war.
Right.
And I have so much respect for people who work in those environments or are deployed for the military or who grow up there, because they endure it and continue to survive and keep their humanity and have so much respect for that, because it is very difficult and very demanding.
Yeah, and I think you've alluded to, and not just alluded to, but mentioned in your book and in your talk as well, that there are still things that will kind of trigger from time to time. And my father did the same thing when PBS did the series on World War II, when they did that section on Iwo Jima. That was, he had trouble sleeping for a couple of weeks after that, because it was so real bringing him back to that.
Right.
I thoroughly understand and appreciate that part of it.
But writing the book was very therapeutic as well. I feel like a lot of the burden's been lifted off and removed, because it's now, you know, I've reached back and deep as far as I can into my emotions and feelings and soul to try and get it out, and that was hard, but now it's done. It feels like the load is a lot lighter.
It's manageable to that extent.
Yeah.
So having dived deep into the book, clearly you went there. You still worked for the BBC, but you didn't become a correspondent.
Yeah, that's the too long, didn't read version for anyone who's interested. Yes, I went to Afghanistan to see if I'd like the life of a foreign correspondent. I was at that point in my career where it was an option for a possible career path. And to be honest, probably was a bad place to start because it scared the heck out of me. And I decided that maybe I'd be better off pursuing another avenue. So I did discover that in moments of crisis, I become very serene, so I can make good decisions. And I thought, well, maybe that would be good for live radio news production, which it turned out to be terrific. There was still a lot of stress, but no one was trying to kill me, which is, you know, a definite plus.
That's a savior.
A career path. there was that, and then that became a lot of fun. I remember the first time I was P1ing, so the senior producer on NewsHour, which is the flagship program of the BBC World Service, and so as senior producer, you pretty much have editorial control of the broadcast. We had worked all day very hard to prepare a one-hour program, and then 2 minutes before airtime, they shot the Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, and so we had to throw the entire program out and start from scratch live on air. So you can imagine that's the kind of stress I was okay at dealing with, and not the mortal danger part of it. So I made my career doing that instead.
And in terms of leveraging your background, I think you've had a penchant and a desire to understand history. So that helps when you kind of shift things from time to time.
That's like the defining feature of my life. Since before I can remember, I was, single digits, like 7, 8, 9. I started reading history books and just was have not been able to stop. I just immersed myself in what's been going on in the past, because it's so much more interesting than fantasy, because this actually happened. So I went on to do history at university and struggled to find somewhere to give myself an outlet for that in my career, but was able to bring to find in international, when I became an international broadcast journalist, that historical foundation was immensely useful in trying to understand and explain the currents of world events, and has continued to be my passion in many cases up in different ways to this day, yes.
So from BBC, how did you get to Franklin? BBC is, most people would know, certainly is in England, but obviously they have bureaus and associations.
In the 90s, WGBH, the big local public broadcaster, decided it would be good to do an international news program. And so they were looking for partners to collaborate with on public radio. And out of that, those discussions with different partners, which ended up started with Public Radio International out of Minnesota, initially as just the distributor, and then the BBC World Service was looking for partners to collaborate with, because obviously the BBC historically broadcast on shortwave, on radio, and as the 90s were transferring into the digital age, mm-hmm. the BBC was looking to find ways to get onto local FM stations, as the clearly was going to be the future mm-hmm. of radio. And so out of that came a program called The World, which was created at the GBH studios in Boston. And the BBC, ever anxious for its reputation, thought that, well, we can't let our brand be used by these people without having some people that we can trust to oversee the news. And so 5 BBC journalists came over for a year, and I was one of them, just on loan to get the program established, as it were. And 1 year became 2, and 2 years became 3, and it was. And then along came 9/11, and many Americans found themselves asking questions like, "Why do they hate us?" And it felt like the moment of the program had arrived. And so it really was, for many years, a very fulfilling and satisfying career trying to bring the world into American mm-hmm. Living rooms and cars for people's commutes to try and figure out what's going on in the world and why it matters to people.
Yeah.
And so it became a very attractive place. And so I stayed and rose through the ranks there, into management for a while, and then gently moved into being on air talent.
Chosen another pathway.
As the history guy. So for 7 years, my last 7 years with The World, I was the history guy and would explain the historical context for affairs in the news. For I remember, you know, one of the early successes was the debate about immigration, and then, of course, what was Russia's interest in Ukraine, which again has become very topical again.
Again, all of a sudden, yes, yeah. But there's been some story, depending upon where you want to go back in history, that's been a long story.
Well, I always like to describe history as like an onion. You peel off one layer, that's interesting, but then there's another layer beneath, and you can keep peeling down to a very granular level or going back in time. The level of detail is just a wonderful thing to behold. And then it's the difficulty for a good historian is to be the storyteller that can capture the most interesting parts mm-hmm. without sounding too technical or too inside baseball, where you lose mm-hmm. that human story element. You got to keep the facts in there, but pick which facts you can fit into the narrative that you're trying to convey, and keep it accessible at mm-hmm. the same time.
Yeah, well, at least based upon, and I was familiar with The World, although I can't say in my recording or listening history at the time, I don't recall that piece of it specifically, but I was familiar with The World, have listened to it from time to time, but then having more recently listened to you tell the story of bumbling through you do have a way of telling the story with some of the key pieces.
Yes.
And I can imagine there's other pieces that haven't made it out there yet,
because
there's just other places to go, but it didn't really carry the arc. So you just carried the arc and
right.
kept
I like
it
to,
going.
You know, as I encounter places, I'll weave in a little bit of background about them and their what's happening there. I always love a good movie where they don't hit you over the head, like a historical movie, they don't hit mm-hmm. you over the head with what's happening.
Right.
They'll form it into part of the dialogue, so you kind of absorb the information you need just from the conversations people are having without mm-hmm. having to be hit over the head with a lecture about, you know, why this is important or not, or what's happening. Yeah, so in the book, I just hope to give people enough context about who's shooting at whom and why, and for example, the historical experience of other empires in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
When I was there, the most recent presence had been the Soviet one, and it was devastating to see the damage that they did to the society and to the fabric of the country as well, to fight the Islamic rebels of the time.
Right, of the time. And that, so BBC brought you to the greater Boston area, and then time passes somewhere along the way, and you end up in Franklin.
Well, yes. Yeah, so I was living in, ended up in Alston Brighton, right close to the GBH studio for many years, and then in Framingham. And then, well, got divorced, as happens to many people, and found a lovely new partner in 2016, and she happened to live in Franklin. So, yes, it's a love story that brought me to Franklin. And obviously, I want to say obviously, I don't want to disrespect neighboring communities, but the part of Framingham I was living in was less attractive than the Franklin where she lived, and so I moved into her place, and mm-hmm. we've built an addition now, so it feels more like our house, and love the city.
Yes, we chose to come here in 95 as part of a corporate move, etc. They had the opportunity to move me, and I said, you're going to move me home? Okay, sure. Because I had grown up in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, so we're not that far away from the home base, and a lot of the family's still around. And yeah, we spent a lot of good time here. The kids, as I mentioned, I think have grown up through here. My wife was teaching for many years. She's now retired, and now in my retirement, I'm having fun continuing to do Franklin Matters, and because Franklin does matter, and I want to share the stories as well as to what's happening, focusing on kind of the business of the town itself, because that, in effect, helps us as individuals live, because we've got roads to work with, we've got restaurants to go to, and all those kind yep. of other things are what makes the community. Yeah. Obviously, the people are key as well.
Thank you for that. And I just love living in Franklin.
One of the questions that, having been on a trip personally to Kenya and having exposure to the Kenya-Tanzania borderline, which to a certain extent doesn't really exist. There was this one stake, actually a cement or granite piece in the ground. The borders in Afghanistan with their neighboring countries, and then the structure of Afghanistan, that was also, there's no real border, like almost to a certain extent. You don't get the kind of the sign mark that says, you're welcome to Rhode Island, welcome to Massachusetts. you're just out there.
Yeah, so there are obviously like border posts, like manned by, staffed by the people of the respective countries that they're on, are most of the major roads.
Major roads.
There are no railroads in Afghanistan, so forget that. But on there are the major roads, there are the border points that you would expect, you'd find on the northern or southern borders here in the United States.
Right.
Well, not quite like that at all. But, you know, at least they're checking your passport.
They're checking,
and making sure you're, there's not too much going on. But beyond that, in almost the entire frontier is undemarcated. You can just walk across, and the minor roads, there's very little in the way of security of any kind or control. And the people living along the borders, a lot of them don't even if they know the border is there, they don't care, because they'll keep marrying and going shopping and herding sheep from one area to another without any regard for the border, because in a sense the borders are there was an Afghan emirate in the 1800s, and it grew and waxed and waned with its own, you know, military fortunes, but it's buffered up against the borders of the empires of Persia, British India, and Russian Central Asia, and it's so the interests of those powers dictated where many of the borders were set, and not the facts of geography or the human population as well. So a lot of the people who live along the border have cousins and family on either side, so which is great for sustaining an insurgency, not so good for internal order.
Yeah, for maintaining kind of a central control, because to your point, with there's no railroad going through the city, going through the county, the country, there's some control, but there's not that immediate kind of control, because the local lords or local leaders are really kind of in charge. And if they coalesce around something, then that's where some things happen.
And one of the things I try and explain in the book about what makes Afghanistan more complex is that being an Afghan is only one of your identities. Mm. You I think, despite all our differences, most Americans would agree that we're Americans, and then everything else is secondary, whatever political party or region you're from. Whereas in Afghanistan, those identities can compete and change over time. So you elect to identify with either your language group or your locality, or some people, you know, will insist that Afghan is their primary identity, but not everybody. And then there are traditional groupings as well. Some might call them tribes in some areas, but the kinship group is the primary one. So you find all these conflicting identities are conflicting over time, and so it's very hard to pin down where somebody is. Yet he may wear a uniform of one organization, but he may have, in a sense, a biddable loyalty to another identity as well. So it makes politics very complicated and dangerous.
Yes, because I think there was one point where it turned out that there were cousins and they were on opposite sides.
So, what I witnessed myself was traveling with a humanitarian aid convoy, and the guy running the convoy for the United Nations hops out and starts browbeating this Afghan army officer into negotiating a ceasefire with the people who the road ahead of us on this valley. There's only one way through. The road was blocked by fighting, and he's browbeating this army officer to reach out to the rebel commander to negotiate a ceasefire to allow the humanitarian aid convoy to get by. And I'm thinking, well, this isn't going to happen. We'll be back at the club having a drink in Kabul by sundown, surely, at this rate. And but to my surprise, he negotiated the ceasefire, got the two sides to agree. We had a two-hour window to get through the pass. And he hopped back into the car and said, well, that was an easy one because they're cousins. And it just goes to show that those people that had they still had that kinship connection across the battlefield.
The relationships.
Even though they had, at that time, selected to be on different sides, as it were, of the war, which is... It's very hard for Americans to grasp that identity and loyalty can be malleable and shifting over time, but it happens.
It does. So having come here, settled, you wrote the book, is there potentially another book in the future?
So I have about 6 or 7 unfinished projects ranging from fiction to nonfiction. One of my other passions is the American Revolution. So I have invested a lot of energy in trying to figure out what actually happened in the American Revolution, particularly from the British military point of view, because I grew up on the same myths in England, because we had to explain, you know, it's the only war we've lost in 1,000 years, you know, how it happened. So we've accepted a lot of American myths about the better guerrilla fighters and yada, yada, yada. And then when I came here and started doing research after I got involved in military history reenacting for the American Revolution.
Okay.
I ended up as a redcoat on Lexington Green many times.
Yes.
And discovered that the light infantry training that they had was probably on a par with what I went through myself as a teenage reserve soldier, and fire and maneuver, all those kinds of things.
Right.
I couldn't believe it. So what happened? So like back to the layers of the onion, you start peeling away and you find that what really happened was much more interesting than the popular myths we all grew up on. So that they were really quite good. And in many ways, the British competence is a compliment to the Americans, that they still were able to survive. So I don't see how it cheapens the national myth.
No.
Because if you assume that the enemy were fools and could be just, you know, shot down like flies, then it doesn't really give you that much credit. Whereas when you find that they actually are a competent, hard-fighting army, then it's another ball of wax. So you can tell there's a passion there.
Certainly.
I can't imagine I would grow rich or selling. I think I know.
It's not that it's been an untapped market for
I think I know the 6 people in the world who would buy an arcane book about British military administration in the 1770s. But you know, there's a lot of I put a lot of work into that, and I have some fiction projects as well that are also kind of historical fiction. One in the American Revolution, and well, I don't know if I'll ever get around to doing, but I was thinking of a trilogy on, there was this great episode in British history in the 200s AD when Britain attempted to leave the European Union of the time, the Roman Empire.
Oh.
And there was a violent attempt at secession mm-hmm. by Britannia, and succeeded for many years because of the naval, the Brits managed to control the navy. I was going to call it Brexitus.
Brexitus.
But anyway, that's still in the outline.
It's a working form. It's a working concept.
Yeah, I should have done it 10 years ago.
One other question, somewhat related to what we've been talking about, certainly history has been your passion, et cetera. From a historical perspective, some advice for somebody to, you know, from a historical perspective, what would be the one advice to, you know, pay attention to history, pay attention to this, take an approach in some way, anything in that realm?
In terms of people wanting to find a career in history or wanting to just how they should approach?
To better understand an aspect, clearly there's multiple aspects within it. So how do you make some sense of what's going on here? Do you, you know,
Well, read more than one book.
More than one, certainly. Yes.
So reading a book is great, but even with the best will in the world, the time that the person's writing and the narrative that already exists in their head is going to shape and color what it is that they write. So read different accounts from different periods to try mm-hmm. and get a balanced picture of what really happened if you are passionate about it. Particularly when I was the history guy in the world, a lot of stuff would be at my fingertips, but I always would always fact check
right.
before broadcasting.
Go validate, et cetera.
And
yeah.
It was wonderful to be right many times, but I was even more pleased to find that I was wrong on some occasions than what I could recall was either a mythologized version of the past or mm-hmm. just a not a crank account, but something that somebody hoped would have happened. But it was, as with many things in the news, if it's too good to be true, it probably is.
Yes. So. Yeah, and have you seen potentially, and this kind of taps into kind of the media piece, certainly you've been with the media, with the news media for a bit, and they've evolved over time from the regular major studios, obviously now into the social media world and all of its aspects.
Right.
Has the nature of the news changed as well along that? I mean, the story still needs to be told. It becomes, in some cases, more difficult in some cases, I would think.
Yeah, I have a lot of opinions about that. And so I don't want to take up all your time.
We don't have all day, I understand. Yeah, although we could certainly talk offline as well.
There are parts of the media, and I think every part of it is affected by the sense of there's a powerful argument in journalism that you want to have a narrative journalism to bring identify an individual or a group of individuals whose experiences illustrate the broader point you're trying to make,
mm-hmm.
and which makes total sense. And over time, that's evolved into, well, let's tap into an emotional level and that's the most important thing, and providing the context that explains that has fallen away.
Mm.
And in that sense, I find it frustrating that a lot of news coverage leans towards capturing people's feelings and emotions about a story rather mm-hmm. than trying to explain
the
facts
details of the
and
story
the details
and
about the
yeah.
It's the boring nitty gritty about why something is happening. Because
right.
I remember an early lesson I had at the BBC World Service. There was a lot of popular news coverage in the 1990s about the Bosnian War, about one particular woman who'd been injured, a girl, and she was brought to London for treatment. And I remember the old editor saying, that's not news. I said, but everybody's talking about it. And he said, well, we can go up the hospital where she's at now and we can find 20 other stories that are just as tragic as hers. But that's not news. That's just a tragedy.
Mm.
And so I think he probably took it a little too far. You could use her narrative to illustrate a broader story.
Yep.
But my problem with a lot of news coverage, and one of the reasons I'm happy to be out of the industry now, is that the feelings and opinions don't matter as I seem to matter more to many outlets now than just the facts of what's going on and why it matters.
Yeah, yeah.
Or what it could mean, you know.
Yeah, yeah. The big picture is something, at least in my journalism, I try to provide with the details, with the support. So if I go to a meeting, you'll get the recording. I'm also piloting now a transcript, which is unique because sometimes transcripts, especially when they're AI generated, sometimes they work fairly well. Sometimes it's like, really? Is that what that's what it sounds like?
Yep.
So it's a pilot, clearly. Yeah. We'll learn from that, hopefully. But yeah, as opposed to the opinions and, you know, the sound bites, no, I don't want to go there.
Right.
That's not going to help tell the story that we really need to have told.
Again, if someone is interested in history, for example, or the news, if you can get to the as close as you can to the primary source, you're going to have a clearer idea of what it is that was meant and intended and it was actually happening, rather than trying to parlay it through other people's interpretations. So I'd encourage people to, if you see somebody quoting somebody saying something, then see if you can find where that was being said.
Yeah,
to
go back up the line to find
that it was and it was not taken out of context.
Yep. And an adjunct, and I think you're still somewhat in media. Are you doing some voiceover business?
Yes. So my wife and I have a voiceover company called The Voice Depot, based here in sunny Franklin. And we do voiceovers mostly for e-learning and corporate training videos, but some advertisements as well and some phone systems, that kind of thing, wherever we can find business. So, yep, give us a call. Look us up, thevoicedepot.com. And happy to help anybody.
Yep. And we'll include that in the show notes, along with the links to the book.
Thank you.
There's an Amazon Audible version is the one I listen to. And it's your voice. So having listened to you now, you'll be able to hear, oh, yes, that's the same guy. That was him.
That was an interesting experience because there was one part where, you know, there were some disturbing pieces. And when I was reading it again, got very emotional while I was reading it. And then I had this debate with myself. Should I leave that kind of heavy sigh moment and a little bit of profanity when I was recalling the incident as I was reading the audiobook? And I ended up cutting it out, but I was going back and forth about whether to do that or not. But
So were you more the editor in that case, or was there...
No, I edited the editing as well myself.
Okay, apologize. We get into some of the geeky stuff here, too. As we're sitting here at a control board with lots of buttons that I don't necessarily know all about, but I have fun playing with.
So it's almost word for word, but there's some points where I caught a few typos thinking, oh, dear, I better say that right.
Yes. Yeah. Pronunciations are key for sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yes. Well, thank you for taking time to spend today to give us a little bit more of your story. The Bumbling Flu Hindu Kush is out and available. You're still as needed on a book tour where other opportunities arise.
Yeah, if anyone thinks that I might make an interesting speaker for their library or museum who hears this, then please reach out through the social media links that Steve has going to be able to provide or through my website. And we'd love to hear from you.
Indeed. Well, thank you again. And for the listeners, we do this because Franklin matters. We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.